and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for joining us on the show this week. I'm talking with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski this week, and we should point out this week's show has been pre-recorded, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls during the program today. But feel free at any time to send an email for any of our four mayors to our address, ask@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, I didn't expect that I was going to have to ask you as you walked in whether you were brushing snow off of yourself, but it seems like this winter just won't quit.
I agree, and boy, to wake up again this morning and see snow after the snow we had just last week and stuff, but I've lived here my whole life. I don't hardly ever remember snow going this late into April, and so it's just one of those things. We've been juggling trucks back and forth between salt boxes and places to haul trees that have blown down. So we've had to do some juggling in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting juxtaposition, because we had the big rain and wind event last week, and we had snow yesterday. How do you manage making sure you have all of the right equipment on the roads, all the right attachments on that equipment to make sure that you're dealing with whatever nature is throwing at us today?
Well, I want to give credit to our fleet maintenance facility that takes care of that, because honestly, it is a significant undertaking. I mean, as you can imagine, we here in Indiana with snow part of the year, and then the other part of the year, those trucks are picking up leaves, limbs, large items, hauling asphalt, doing different things. And so we don't and shouldn't spend the money or have the luxury of having a set of fleet of trucks that just set over here till winter with all the equipment on it and set over here for the nice months. We have to move those back and forth. And so literally when that last forecast came through previous to the snow we had yesterday, we had broke down about every truck except about six of them in the fleet, because people were already putting out leaves, cleaning up their yards. We had some nice days. So we literally spent 2 days putting 90% of the fleet back together to be prepared for snow, just in case, you know, we did get quite a bit of snow. Thank goodness it didn't stick to the roads, and we had to put them back together. We saw some potential for bad weather, so we've broke down about half the fleet at this point that we have ready for leaves, limbs, things like that. And then, you know, in case something else would happen, and as we had the other night with the significant event, we had to have trucks ready that were ready to haul limbs and stuff.
Kind of one foot in one season, one foot in
the other. Absolutely, yeah.
How did you fare with, I know there were some large trees that were down from the wind event that happened. Tell me how you've taken stock of that and how you've assessed what happened with the city. Do you have a number of trees that were down? I know power was out in some places for several hours and things like that.
Yeah, we had about 15 trees down that we were responsible for that would be the city's responsibility. And so as soon as the storm passed, we have a good communication system with dispatch, and the street department brought in. We have chainsaw crews, and we have plenty of chainsaws and trucks. So we did bring in crews that evening that worked for several hours, getting them cut up, pulled off the roads, ones that we could. I mean, sometimes with power lines in them, we can't do anything with them until that part's been taken care of. And so we got it. We got all the roads open that first night, got it cut up enough what we could to get the ones that were across the roads and things like that, and came back in the next day. And we called in about six crews the first night, about 12 people, two people to a crew that worked through the night to get the roads open, make sure everything was okay by morning. Then over the next couple days, we cut up the rest of the stuff and got it all hauled away.
Let me ask you about the power lines, because I wondered if when something like this happens and you've got power lines that go down, and of course this city, like so many others, has lots and lots of overhead power lines in places. There's been a trend in recent municipal planning to have more of those buried, if at all possible. Mm-hmm. Do you have an ability when something like this happens to go to Duke or whoever and say, hey, would you consider not having this happen again by trying to bury more power lines, things like that? Is this a way for you to change the way that the infrastructure works at all in your city?
Well, I mean, we would love to do that, but I mean, they will bury them, but they charge you to bury them. So, you know, we have had places where we've asked them to bury them, or we have developments where they're buried, and we've even done paid and had some of the additional ones done slowly over time. But it's, you know, incredibly expensive. We wanted to do that some areas out on Sagamore Parkway and literally would, you know, add millions of dollars to the project. But that is something that we do and will continue to do. But it doesn't happen at a very large pace because there is an expense to that for us. We looked at doing some more downtown that we'd like to get buried. It would get rid of just kind of like three poles. And, you know, that was about $150,000 to get just do enough to get rid of those three poles with what it would cost us. So, but we're going to continue the discussions with Duke and with the other providers. As you may or may not saw last year, we quickly put together a resolution after some changes were made in the telecom bills for small cell towers, things like that, to kind of protect us from getting any more towers in areas we didn't want it, more overhead wires, some things like that. But unfortunately, a state law passed this time that undermined all local ordinances, so the protection that we put in for ourselves last year got wiped out with a new state law. So we're kind of back to the drawing board on, you know, working with those different providers because, one, because of storm situations, it certainly is better. But, two, from an aesthetic value, you know, we're doing lots of work downtown and other places, and then, you know, to have lines just crisscrossing back and forth between everything just, you know, I think detracts from the aesthetic value, the quality of life that we want to have. And so we're certainly want to continue to have those discussions. But some protection we did try to give ourselves last year in the form of a resolution was kind of wiped off the books this year by a new state law.
Well,
that
you and 100 other cities in Indiana, from what I understand.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the trees, too. If you mentioned there were a few trees that the city had to take care of, but obviously many more of those are going to be on residential property. Would you encourage people who see a tree that they think might be dangerous or they see might be dropping limbs on or near their property to do something like use the city's cell phone app to report a tree and maybe shoot you a picture of it and say, hey, you know, city guys, I think this tree might be dangerous the next time we have a storm. Is that the kind of thing you'd want people to let you know about?
Yeah, we certainly always want that type of input from our citizens. And if they snap a picture in a location, as you indicated, that makes it a lot easier for us and let our city forester evaluate those trees, particularly the ones, you know, that are in the parkways that we try to work on. And we remove so many hazardous trees a year. We have a hazardous tree fund as part of the budget, and we go through and remove so many hazardous trees each year that we think are the worst ones. I mean, obviously, if it's up on private property right in the middle of people's front yards, we will send notices encouraging them to do that and the potential liability that might incur if they don't. And but that is a difficult situation when it's on private property. And sometimes we do get put in the middle between a neighbor with another neighbor who feels the dangerous tree's leaning over, a limb's leaning over. They want the city to go in and cut that down. We can't go into that private property and cut somebody's tree down, and we can't get in that business anyway. So we try to kind of negotiate those and get people talking and get people to do the right thing. But certainly out in front, in the parkways, the right-of-ways, and anything that might fall across the sidewalk or into a roadway, we'd certainly like to know about it.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. We have pre-recorded this week's show, so we can't take your phone calls, but please do send emails for any of our mayors to ask@wbaa.org. I wanted to get to a listener question that's come in. Amanda has written in saying, I'm sending this question on behalf of a 12-year-old Lafayette resident who is passionate about urban chickens. And the question is from young Colin, who says, could we have chickens in Lafayette? He says, West Lafayette allows chickens, so we can learn from them.
So, well, thank you, Colin, for your question. We certainly appreciate that and appreciate at your young age getting involved. You know, we've had the chicken question come before us a couple different times and before the city council. And up to this point, it's just not been something that we've been interested in doing. The vast majority of people, we've had a few people bring it to us, but we've had significantly more people that were against it than were for it as we've had these discussions. And so we've never moved forward on that. You know, there's a lot of different research out there on urban chickens and kind of the pros and the cons. And at this point, it seemed that we had more people in the neighborhoods and stuff that were against that as were for it. And so we've not pursued that. Not to say we wouldn't, you know, entertain keeping an open mind about that. But at this point, you know, the council, as we've just not pursued that any further because it seemed like we have more people that were against it than were for it.
And remember that you can send questions to ask@WBAA.org. Tweet them as well at WBAA News on Twitter. Something that is being considered right now is possibly extending your ability through economic development income tax funding to spend a little bit more money on law enforcement to help deal with drugs and drug crime in the city. Tell me where that discussion is at the moment.
Well, you know, I was approached by one of the county commissioners to see if we might be interested in looking at that issue. The county has experienced significant increases in cost at the courthouse and security and different law enforcement costs, primarily related to the opioid issue. And the city of Lafayette has also, you know, we have, as I said, on this show before, the city budgets went up about $4 million over the last 5 years. Most of our, even though our crime is down 20% because of some of the programs that we've implemented, those programs aren't free. And we're going to need to be able to sustain those over long periods of time. And most of our serious crime is related to drug abuse and to the opioid situation. And so there's a mechanism that was created several years ago by the state legislature that deals with our economic development income tax, which actually has been changed now to local option income tax. They've changed the acronym and the title there that gave communities a couple options years ago. One, some of the communities were really, really hit hard when tax reassessment went into play, when the final decisions were made by the courts on how property had to be assessed at fair market value and some different things like that, that there was a mechanism to raise that just a little bit and that money could go to property tax relief. And there was also a mechanism that was put in there that none of us here locally have ever taken advantage of, that you could raise that by a small percentage, but that money had to go specifically towards law enforcement. And we've never taken advantage of that or used that at this point. But there is discussion in the community now. I think everybody agrees that public safety is an important priority. I think everybody sees that all the departments, including the county, the courts, are doing a lot of different things and at a lot higher level than we've had to deal with before because of the opioid situation.
If this goes through, do you have a sense of how much money you would raise and what specifically you'd spend that on?
Yeah, I mean, we would raise probably right around $1 million or so that the city of Lafayette would get, and then the county would get some and West Lafayette would get some. And, you know, we would continue to do that in three primary areas. I mean, it's really no different than what I've talked about if we were involved in the opioid lawsuit, that if we got money from that lawsuit, we would use money towards, except I don't think I can give this money. I'm not sure I can give this money to a private addiction service, but we would certainly use this money towards education. If there was a way that we could use that to help with addiction services in some way, and then enforcement, that we would, with those, you know, I still believe that those are the three prongs of solving this problem is education, addiction services, and enforcement. And we would use those, that money in those three buckets.
There are probably some people out there who might say, look, I'm not part of the opioid problem. Why should I be paying a tax that's going to go to solve this problem? What would you say to them?
Well, I certainly understand their feelings, but we are a community. And as a community, when there's a community issue, and this is a national issue, you know, sometimes we all have to pull together to do the right things for the right reasons. And in some way, we are probably all affected by the opioid crisis, whether it is a family member, a loved one, whether it's somebody that might have had somebody that's on drugs do something that did harm their family or harm their property or did something to diminish their quality of life in some way. We're probably, none of us are totally immune from the opioid crisis. And so I would say I understand that. And again, this is not something that we've voted on yet. This is just the very initial discussion phases. I think Commissioner Byers told me the calculation was looked at. And again, this is just an estimate from memory at this point. I think he said it'd be about maybe $35 a person on average for the year is about what that would work out. And so if you break that down by month, you know, if we could do the things that were necessary to speed up the ability in our community to help us get through this opioid crisis, I think that would be money well spent. And I think most people in the community, knowing that it has to go to law enforcement, that it's got to go to law enforcement, would be, you know, at least be open-minded about the discussion, knowing that there were parameters on how that money could be used and had to be within that law enforcement bucket.
On another law enforcement topic, I was reading some of the press releases that have come from your police department the last couple of weeks about some shootings and other violent acts that have happened, and they do a good job of keeping in touch with us in the media when these things happen. And so I went on to the crime tracking website, and I looked at the first, say, 100 days of this year and the first 100 days of last year, and something struck me that I wanted to ask you about from your background as a former officer yourself. The number of crimes, almost identical. I think it was 17 this year and 16 last year, or vice versa. So just about exactly the same crime rate. But what I noticed was last year, the crime was very centered in what I would consider the city center, you know, bounded by the river and Sagamore Parkway and 52. And it seems to be spreading out a little bit this year, a little more out to the east, a little more down to the south and southwest. Can you read anything from that? Is that, or is it a big enough sample size to get any useful data out of, do you think?
Well, it's probably a little bit early to try to draw any significant conclusions from that. And I mean, society is incredibly mobile these days, right? We're incredibly mobile in the use of technology. And what we've also learned is that so many times the preemptive activity that caused a crime to actually be committed many times will begin at one location and will finish in another location where it finally erupts to where you have some type of assault or a shooting or some type of robbery or a drug deal that ends up going bad, which in many cases these are. So that's a little bit hard to draw a conclusion from this early on. And really, you'd almost have to look at each individual report to see where that situation actually started and where, if it ended up in the same place or if it had some movement to it throughout sometimes an hour, maybe a 4 or 5 hour window of a evening of people, unfortunately, many times drinking and using illegal narcotics.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA, talking today with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. Send your questions via email to ask@WBAA.org, though we will say this show has been pre-recorded, so if you've got a question for Mayor Rozworski, we'll be sure to get it on next month's show. I wanted to ask about what is actually the busiest intersection in the county, South Street or US 26 and Indiana 26 and Sagamore Parkway. It's undergoing construction just like it has last summer as well, and I had somebody say that they didn't think there was appropriate signage there to say that depending on what direction you were going, a driver might have to make a U-turn. So they were wondering, is there a possibility to get at least more signage up there to make sure that people know that that's what's going to happen to them if they're in their cars?
Well, we can certainly take a look at that. We want to make it as easy as possible. I was out there a couple weeks before that project closed to make sure the signboards were up saying that the road was going to close on April 2nd, and those signboards were up, and the additional ones are up now that says that it's closed at Hannon Drive there, right there by Carpetland. And I don't know if it specifically says on it you'll have to make a U-turn, but we've said the road is closed there. You can get up to the businesses and stuff to that point, but certainly we want to continue to evaluate, and if there's a way that we can make that clearer and better, for drivers. We certainly want to do that. We appreciate everybody's patience. We're hopefully very close to the last 90 days of a multi-year, multi-million dollar project that spans several miles. So we appreciate everybody's patience. And if you can find an alternate route, even an alternate of the prescribed detour, if you even know your streets really well and you can find a route that's even a little bit further out than that, we certainly would appreciate it.
While we're on the subject of signage, if you'll indulge me, I wanted to ask something that I've never gotten to ask one of the mayors I've had on this program before, and that's about no turn on red signs. And there are, of course, many good reasons to have those for angles that you just can't see or traffic that you might not realize is coming at you as fast as it is. So let me start with this. I think there are a lot of them in Greater Lafayette. And I was thinking if I were the person who had to decide how to put these things up, I would imagine I would have a good reason to put one up and then I would forget that I had done it after some time had passed. And so what I wanted to ask was, first of all, how do you decide when those specific signs get put up at intersections? What kind of process leads to that decision making?
Well, you hit it very well. The city engineer and the our director of our traffic improvement division, which is Fred Koning. I mean, as we build intersections or intersections are reconstructed or things change, we look exactly what you said. We look at primarily sight alignment. You know, how well can you see to make that right turn? That is a huge factor. And then we look at traffic volume and typical speeds on the road. So, you know, is the road an arterial? Is it a thoroughfare? Is it a neighborhood street? You know, something like that, that carries less traffic, more traffic, high-speed traffic. And those are the primary factors that have to do with it. And a lot of it is sight, because even if it's a road where the traffic's not real heavy and the speeds aren't real high, if you can't see, it's still dangerous. And so those are the primary factors that are used. And those signs do come down from time to time, not a lot. You know, we do continually, Fred and his crews are out always working on intersections, always working on lights, but primarily we probably make those changes because citizens call in and say, hey, it seems like this could come down here. There's not a good reason, and that gives us a reason to go out and evaluate those, because I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we have a specific schedule that we go out so many days a month or so many days a year and do nothing but look at no turn on red signs, because that's not the case. Those guys are very busy. We have lots of signals and lots of intersections that they're continually working on. So I would encourage people like yourself, a good question, if you see an intersection where you're not sure why or doesn't look like it still needs to be there, let us know. If we can get it down, we will, because we do take them down. And even with the flashing yellows that we have now for left turns, like off of Sagamore, that was something new for us. That wasn't something before this project that we've ever did, and that's got I probably get more compliments about that than anything, and it does move. It is amazing how much extra traffic that moves on each light cycle. So if people see things where they think we can improve, let me know. If we can, we'll do it. It doesn't have to be my idea. If it makes us better, we'll do it.
And we'll point out to people again that through the city's app and things like that, it's a way that they can do that for
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is that another completely esoteric question? Is that the kind of thing that you have a list of? Is there a list somewhere of here's all of the no turn on red signs in Lafayette?
You know, we have a lot of our signs that we have went out that we have GPS locations for, even our stop signs, our speed limit signs, you know, our traffic signals now, almost all of them are on a management system. They're almost all run by fiber optics, where we can literally, from a computer, set and change the timings of the signals, like for Purdue football games, and then have it go back to normal cycle at a certain time with nobody having to touch anything but program a computer. And so,
no, but I mean the physical signs themselves.
Oh, the physical sign themselves. You know, I don't just make stuff up. So I'm not sure if we have an actual paper list somewhere of every no turn on red sign in the city or not.
No, that's part of my point is I think this might be a hard thing to review because I would be a little surprised if such a list existed. Yeah.
Our best review typically, because people aren't shy about getting a hold of us, and I'm glad they do feel comfortable, is if they see a place where it just doesn't seem to make sense to them, that they're sitting there where they can't turn on red, they'll let us know. But I'll check with Fred Konings, our supervisor of TID. I'll double check with that and try to have you an updated answer the next time we talk.
All right. A couple more things in our last few minutes here. I noticed that your city's Board of Works has begun passing some changes that'll facilitate Loeb Stadium's construction and the traffic around it. You're planning on adding a stoplight near the park there. Are you expecting construction to begin on that project this year, later this year?
Well, the actual physical process of the project begins at the end of the 2019 baseball season.
Okay.
But those early action items that you talked about, yes, those will begin this year. Our goal is to get as much of the underground utility work done as possible. So when we get ready to do the demolition, that's done. So we'll begin rerouting that water main this year and get that all rerouted. We'll get the sewer rerouted, and we're going to get all the underground stormwater utilities in and the storage in for that and try to get all of that done yet this year. So then in 2019, when that season is done, we can just start the demolition. And back to your earlier question a little bit, we're going to spend about $250,000 to bury some overhead lines in that area that we don't want around our stadium. So we'll be working with Duke to get those buried this year too, so we can get that done to get some of those overhead lines in that area underground.
All right. And I also noticed where your city council is considering increasing the number of people who serve on your bicycle and pedestrian safety committee from 7 to 11. You and I have talked about this committee on the show before. This is a committee that you get submitted a list of names and you sign off on those names. Why the consideration of increasing from 7 to 11 constituents on that committee?
Well, that was actually something that I asked for personally. We got the names submitted, and boy, I'll tell you, there were so many qualified people that and some of them I knew and some of them I didn't know. So Cindy Murray and I, the city clerk, actually sat down and personally interviewed most of the people that applied, because I didn't know them. They had some really good qualifications and some really good ideas.
How many people are we talking about?
Oh, I think I interviewed 8 or 9 people. Some of the people on the list I knew pretty well, right? And they were pretty involved already. So I didn't interview every person, but I interviewed significant number of them because I did know them and I had some really good ideas. And after that, I said, you know, we need to be able to take advantage of some of these people, their expertise, their enthusiasm. They want to be involved, and limiting ourselves just to that 7, I really didn't feel was in the best interest of the committee. And then I got thinking, too, about, you know, 7, a couple people can't come, emergency, bad timing, work. You know, we can be down to 5 people really easy for a meeting. And so by getting it to 11 and with some really good people that really interested in cycling and pedestrian and running, even if 4 people can't come, then you still at least have 7 people there discussing things. And so,
and thus have a quorum.
Yeah. So really it was the quality of the applicants was really good.
And so it's worth noting also that now 6 of the people are described as, and I'm quoting now, Lafayette residents who are interested in serving as a member of the committee. So they're going to make up a majority of that committee, too.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. We've run out of it for this program, but we'll look forward to doing it again next month.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can check in with us at the same time next week for our conversation with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. And if you'd like to email a question for him or indeed for any of our other mayors, you can feel free to send an email to ask@WBAA.org. You can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. You can find all of these these shows archived at our website, WBAA.org, and we know that many of you check in with Ask the Mayor on a weekly basis from the WBAA app, and so shortly after this program airs on Thursday at 1 o'clock for the first time, you'll typically be able to find that on the app and take the program with you as well. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.